This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Shallow Graves by Callie Wallace, performed by Emily Wu Zeller. Chapter 1. The first time I killed a man, it was an accident. He didn't have any identification on him. He was white, probably in his mid-50s. Average build, average height. Smoker. No tattoos or distinguishing scars. His fingerprints matched those found at a 30-year-old crime scene in North Dakota. A family murder. Both parents, son and two daughters, all killed one night at the dinner table. Nobody was ever arrested. A real estate agent with the unfortunate name of Poppy Treasure found him 3 days after I killed him. She opened the back door of an empty house to air it out before her clients arrived. And there he was, face down on the lawn, dead. The police released a description and pleaded for information, but nobody came forward. Nobody admitted to seeing him. They didn't even know how he had gotten to Evanston, much less how or why he had ended up dead in the yard of a foreclosed house in the back lot. There wasn't a mark on him. The medical examiner blamed the death on a heart attack, but the unusual circumstances of where he was found made them suspicious. They meant my grave. There was a hole in the backyard of that empty house, about 5 feet long and 18 inches deep. And in that hole they found hair, blood, fibers. Everything I left behind was too degraded for identification purposes. That's what you become when you die but don't manage to do it properly. Too degraded. This is how I killed him. I woke in the dark, choked on a mouthful of mud, and I panicked. I clawed my way through the soil and sod until I found air, and there was a pair of hands, his hands, scooping the dirt away from my face. He was murmuring as he dug. Oh, you're perfect. You're beautiful. You're perfect. There was dirt in my ears, packed around my head, but I could hear him. His voice was breathless, excited but quiet. Calm down, sweetheart. Calm down. He cupped his hands around my head and tugged at my hair. I couldn't see. I couldn't breathe. I didn't want him touching me. I grabbed his wrists, and I pulled. I didn't make a decision. My mind was blank with fear. Everything was wrong, twisted and nauseating. There was something foul in him I wanted to destroy. A dark, quivering thread stretched taut between us. And I broke it. He died. He died. And two things happened. My heart, limp and lifeless, began to beat again. And all of the man's memories about the murders he had committed 30 years ago flooded into me. I remembered children slumped over their dinners of pork roast and potatoes. The littlest girl had fallen out of her chair. Blood soaked the tablecloth, the carpet, streaked the wallpaper in bright splashes. I felt the kick of the shotgun and my bloody hand slick on the knife. The winter wind was cold and howling through an open door. I smelled rosemary and beer and piss. The children had wet themselves. The woman took her last breath. It gurgled in her throat, and she was gone. I remembered it all as though I had been there. I still remember. It's faded now, but the memories I steal never disappear entirely. That family, whoever they were, they died almost 15 years before I was born, in a state I had never visited. But I am the only person left in the world who knows what happened to them. Their killer was there when I woke up. He was dead before I saw his face. I know what he did, but I don't know his name. It was an accident, the first time I killed. It was an instinct I didn't know I had. I never made a choice. The second time was on purpose. Chapter 2. It was late afternoon and a storm was coming. The wind was picking up, and there were towering thunderheads stacked high in the west. Down the interstate, lightning flashed through a black curtain of rain. I was sitting outside a truck stop west of Omaha, Nebraska, perched on a low brick wall that enclosed a bed of wilting flowers. I had my backpack hooked around one arm, my skateboard at my feet, my eyes hidden behind a pair of pink heart-shaped sunglasses. I watched strangers stop, park, head into the convenience store or the restrooms, return to their cars. They frowned at the storm and drove away. I couldn't decide who to approach. Families were out of the question. Nobody invited a stranger into their car with their kids, not even a stranger who looked as harmless as I did. Same with most elderly couples. Young couples or groups of college students were a better bet. The right mix of careless and sympathetic. Some of them would give me a few bucks or offer to let me use their phones or buy me a meal. I took the money but turned down the phones and the food. I didn't have anybody to call, and I don't need to eat anymore. I wasn't the only suspicious teenager hanging around. Across the parking lot, a short guy with black hair and black clothes and a lot of piercings was approaching drivers at the pumps and outside the restaurant. He talked to them for a few minutes, handed over a blue paper from a stack, walked away with a thank you and a smile. In between conversations, he tucked flyers beneath the windshield wipers of parked cars. I watched him work, not all that curious, until I realized he was watching me, too. I looked away. I didn't want to attract any attention, but it was too late. The guy wandered over, taking his time. He looked like he couldn't decide if he should speak or not. His face was round and pink-cheeked and spotted with acne. He had a soft gray shadow around him, the kind of shadow I could feel but not see. But I didn't think it was a killer's shadow. It was too feeble for that.
"Hey,"
said the kid. His voice was deeper than I expected, but his smile made him look all of 12 years old.
"You seem like you're in some kind of trouble."
"Not really," I said. I didn't offer anything else. If he was a 30-year-old creep hanging around a truck stop pretending to be a fresh-faced teenager, I didn't want to encourage him.
"Sure, okay,"
he said with a shrug.
"But if you are, here."
He peeled one of his blue papers off the stack and held it out to me.
"I'm not saying you need it, because you're not saying you need it. But if you're heading west and you need a place to stay, it's an option. They're good people."
I took the page from him. "Need help?" it asked in all caps printed across the top. Below, in smaller letters, it encouraged me to visit the Church of the Prairie. There was an address, a little square map with a star marking the spot in western Nebraska, and the promise of a bed, a shower, a hot meal. At the bottom, a Bible verse. "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me." Matthew 25:35. I folded up the paper and shoved it into my backpack.
"Just tell them Danny sent you,"
the kid said. He said it like he had said it 100 times, reading from a script that didn't particularly interest him anymore.
"Not Daniel. Daniel's somebody else. Not that it matters. He's a good guy, too. But I'm Danny."
"Thanks, Danny, not Daniel," I said. I didn't even try to make it sincere. "But I'm fine."
"They're not, like, Jesus freaks or anything,"
Danny said. He shook his black hair out of his face.
"I mean, they are, but they don't care if you aren't. They won't ask any questions. They'll just help you figure out what to do next."
"That's nice of them," I said. I wanted him to go away. He wasn't offering a ride, and he wasn't a killer. He didn't have anything that interested me. "I'm still fine."
"Sure, okay. But sometimes you don't know you need help until it's too late, you know?"
Danny waited. Maybe he wanted me to give in and admit that I had no money, no ride, no one to call. Maybe he could tell just by looking at me that it had been 10 days since I'd managed more personal hygiene than a cold water splash in a gas station bathroom. I let him wait. I stared at him until he shrugged and he said,
"Suit yourself."
He walked away. He looked back a few times, like there was something he wanted to say. I felt a pang of worry, but I ignored it. I looked suspicious enough for perfectly ordinary reasons. A dirty teenage girl in stolen clothes and stupid sunglasses, lurking around a truck stop, alone. He didn't recognize me. It had been over a year, and what had made the local news in Evanston was of no interest in Nebraska. He was just a kid who got paid a few bucks to hand out church flyers in his free time. I lost track of him and went back to searching for my next ride. I didn't have a plan. I hadn't had one since I left Chicago. My first ride had taken me south to Indianapolis before I decided I wanted to go west instead. I hitched a ride with a friendly stoner heading to Iowa City to pick up his little sister from her first year at college. He smoked joint after joint and listened to Fish bootlegs for the entire 5-hour drive. And when we got to Iowa City, he gave me a $20 bill and told me to enjoy life. After we parted ways, I hung around a big interstate gas station, looking as helpless as possible, until I met a gray-haired trucker named Dottie. She grunted with disinterest when I told her my made-up life story. I was a college student whose roommate and ride home for the summer had copped out at the last minute. Dottie only said,
"You don't look like trouble."
And she said,
"You're too young to be out here alone."
And,
"I can take you as far as Omaha. Then my route turns around."
The cab of her truck smelled of cigarette smoke, stale coffee, fast food. She didn't say much during the hours I rode with her, and when she did talk, she talked about her son, who was 29 years old and missing. In December, he had taken a business trip to Pittsburgh and never came home. The cops didn't bother looking. Dottie had taken time off a couple of months back to go and search for him, but she didn't know anything about his business, didn't know his friends or girlfriends or enemies. She spent 2 days driving aimlessly around Pittsburgh in the slushy gray winter. Her son was gone, and she didn't know why. Drug dealer, I decided. Being uncharitable toward a stranger made it easier for me to avoid thinking about my own mother and what she didn't know.
"You can't trust anybody anymore," said Dottie. "Not even your own kid."
Her voice was rough, her eyes sad. Her hopelessness felt like an empty space beside me, a hole eating away the fading echoes of a life. I was relieved when she dropped me at the truck stop and drove away. As the thunderstorm gathered in the west, I rested my feet on my skateboard and rolled it back and forth, back and forth. Across the parking lot, Danny was in conversation with a white-haired old lady. He was smiling and she was charmed. I looked away when he glanced toward me. A few more hours and the gas station employees would notice I was still sitting outside. I had a story ready, but I didn't want to linger. I wanted to keep moving. A few minutes later, my ride showed up. I felt him before I saw him. The sensation was sudden and unmistakable. Killer. It was a busy truck stop, dozens of cars passing through, and it took me a moment to pinpoint him. Second row of pumps, number 5. His car was a blue Corolla. Minnesota plates. He had an eye on the approaching storm as he filled the tank. He didn't clean the windshield. When he was finished, he ripped the receipt from the pump and got back into the car. If he had driven away, I would have put him out of my mind. I would have watched his blue Corolla leave and felt him recede, a fading murmur under my skin, until he was gone. But he didn't. He parked beside the store and went inside. He came out a few minutes later with a soda and a bag of pretzels. He looked so very ordinary, but he felt like a tangled mess of shadows. Weeds and vines and oily black worms beyond the edge of my vision. Dark, squirming shapes at the corners of my eyes. The taste of ash at the back of my throat. All of those things and none of them. It made me think about bonfires, graveyards, dark, damp holes in the ground, about waking up with dirt packed in my mouth and bruises in the shape of fingers around my throat, and the excruciating, exultant pain of a beating heart after a year of stillness. It was the best feeling I knew, and the worst. He wasn't the first person I had found who felt like that. He wasn't the strongest, or the sickest, or the most tantalizing. But he was right there. I looked up and caught his eye. He stopped, and he smiled.
"Hi,"
he said.
"Are you waiting for somebody?"
I sighed, loud and exaggerated. "No," I said. I tried my best to look annoyed with just a hint of worry. "I mean, maybe, I don't know. My roommate was supposed to give me a ride home for the summer, but she changed her mind at the last minute and decided to go visit her boyfriend in New York instead. Her boyfriend she met on the internet. She doesn't even know him." That's what happened to Maria Garcia's cousin last Christmas break. 2 Christmases ago now. I had missed one. I remembered Maria reading text messages and saying, "That's what she gets for rooming with such a slut." Maria had a million cousins, and she loved to gossip about them. It was easy to borrow their lives for my temporary lies. The man asked,
"There's no one you can call?"
"My parents are in Europe," I said. "They told me to buy a bus ticket, but I figured, well, it's just as easy to get a ride, you know. Save me a couple $100.
"Where's home?"
"Denver," I said. I had no idea which direction he had been heading before he pulled off for gas. I didn't know the first thing about Denver. Well, near Denver. Close. The man's smile grew wider, but he checked himself and put on an expression of false concern.
"I'm headed that way."
"Yeah?"
"I know this is weird, but it's a long drive, and I wouldn't mind the company to help me stay awake."
I pretended to think about it. "I don't know."
"Right, I know,"
he said, too quickly.
"I understand. Do you want money for a bus ticket or something? I don't have much cash on me, but I hate to see you stuck here."
I stood up slowly, hooked the backpack over my shoulder. "Where did you say you were going?" He was headed to Utah to visit his mom, and he didn't mind taking I-70 through Denver instead of I-80 through Wyoming on the way. He liked the scenery, he said. Prettier mountains.
"I know how much it sucks to be stranded."
He laughed, and it was almost believable. It would have been if I couldn't feel what he was.
"I'm not a serial killer, I promise."
"That's exactly what a serial killer would say," I said.
"Good point. But it's really not safe for you to hang around here. You look like you could use the help."
I made him wait while I thought about it. I caught sight of Danny walking around the pumps. He was talking to somebody, but he looked over, like he felt me watching. He wasn't smiling his cherubic little kid smile anymore. The storm was blowing closer, the wind growing stronger. The afternoon was dark enough for the cars on the highway to switch on their lights. Those coming from the west were splattered with rain. He wasn't lying about one thing. He wasn't a serial killer. Not yet. He had killed before, but only once. I didn't know his story or his real name yet, but I knew he was a murderer. I couldn't read his thoughts. It's not like that. Not until they die. I don't know if they're bad people or good people, if they enjoy their lives or hate them, if they look forward to every new day or dread it. I don't know if they've been arrested, convicted, imprisoned. I don't know if it was on purpose or an accident. I can only sometimes feel if they regret it. Guilt and regret are such slippery, untrustworthy things. I don't know if they have parents or spouses or children, if they're going home to their wives or if they've left everybody behind. I don't know if they ever had anybody at all. I don't even know if they're human or not. But I always know if they've killed someone. That's not much of a party trick. "Okay," I said. I kicked up my skateboard, caught it in one hand. "Thanks, I'm sick of being stuck here." The man led the way back to his blue Corolla. I put my skateboard in the back seat and let him open the passenger door for me.
"What's your name?"
he asked. Melanie. I felt stupid as soon as I said it. My real name is Breezy, and I had meant to name one of Maria's endless supply of cousins, like I had when Dottie the truck driver asked. But Melanie's name was out before I could stop myself. Saying it aloud felt like a spark of electricity, quick but painful for the moment it lasted.
"Nice to meet you, Melanie," he said. "I'm Tate. Let's hope that storm up ahead isn't as bad as it looks."
Chapter 3. The storm was just as bad as it looked. The rain broke over us with shattering noise. Thunder crashed, and I jumped, laughed uneasily. The man who called himself Tate switched on the wipers and the headlights. He sat forward in the driver's seat, both hands on the wheel, and followed too close behind a minivan slicing wet channels across the asphalt. The traffic marched in lines of white from the west, red straight ahead, blurred and indistinct in the downpour. It was too loud to talk. We crept along for 45 minutes, maybe an hour, barely making any progress before the rain slackened. The man eased back into his seat and turned the wipers down a notch.
"At least it's not a tornado."
"You had to go and say that, didn't you?" The air conditioner was blowing cool air across my skin, raising goosebumps on my arms. I leaned forward to peer through the windshield. "The sky doesn't look green. I hope you didn't jinx us."
"I have better luck than that," he said.
I had always been afraid of thunderstorms before, ever since I was little. My dad tried to explain to me what they were and how they worked. Air pressure and temperature changes, electrical discharges and cloud formations. He thought laying it all out in scientific terms would help. But knowing how lightning happened didn't make it any less frightening. Not when I was 10. That was before. There wasn't much point in being frightened anymore. I stared out the window at the rain-battered fields and wondered what it would be like to be caught in a tornado. Lifted up and tossed around, scoured and stripped and dropped miles away, a bloody piece of debris in a pile of rubble. I could add it to the list. The traffic grew heavier when we passed through Lincoln, dissipated on the other side. It was evening on a Tuesday or Wednesday. I had lost track of the date. The man asked if I minded a short stop to grab some food. He chose a roadside diner with a neon sign and a dirt parking lot. I didn't want anything, but he insisted, so I asked for a milkshake. It was chocolate, but tasted like ash. He ordered the special, pork chop and mashed potatoes and soggy green beans, and he smothered the entire plate in ketchup. He talked about himself while he ate. None of it was true. He told me he was an economics professor from Michigan. I made the appropriate impressed noises to keep him talking, but I couldn't look at him. The smell of his dinner reminded me of a faraway house splattered with blood and small bodies collapsed over their plates. Outside, a rainbow curved over the landscape. The clouds broke briefly to let shafts of evening sun shine through. I blinked. The clouds closed, and the sunlight faded again. I excused myself to the bathroom to throw up the milkshake. My body doesn't digest food anymore. When we were on the road again, the man who called himself Tate laughed self-consciously and said,
"We've got a lot more hours of this great scenery ahead of us, and it only gets more boring from here. Tell me about yourself, Melanie. What are you studying in school?"
I invented a story for him. I wove together pieces of Maria Garcia's cousin, Sandra Olster's stepsister who lived in her parents' basement and played the banjo, Marcus Reyes's brother who had won a swimming scholarship and might be training for the Olympics, bits and pieces of second-hand acquaintances and friends of friends. I told him I was a freshman at the University of Chicago, studying biology or maybe chemistry, and I was going to work as a lifeguard for the summer. I was an only child, and my parents were lawyers. "Not like criminal lawyers," I said. "Car accident lawyers. You know, like the kind you see on TV. I offered a silent apology to my parents for forcing them into such an embarrassing profession. I didn't tell him one true thing about myself. It was easier that way. I was a patchwork person, stolen scraps stitched together with the frailest threads. If he cared at all, he would have seen the lies for what they were. But he didn't care that I was lying to him. Every few moments he tapped nervously on the steering wheel and glanced my way. I didn't need to read his thoughts to know what he was thinking. He was planning, wondering how long he had to drive before he could find an isolated place to pull over. Thinking about what he would say, how he would deflect my worries, what excuse he would give, how it would feel. I leaned into the door and hitched one leg up, hugged my knee to my chest. I hadn't bothered with the seatbelt. If we crashed, that could be another item on my list. I knew I ought to be scared, but all I felt was a faint flutter beneath my ribs that was a little like excitement, a little like hunger. He thought I was helpless, but I knew something he didn't know. He couldn't hurt me. I had never before had that kind of power over someone. I tucked the feeling down in my gut in a tight little ball, small and black like a frightened roly-poly bug, and kept it in the same place where I kept my real name, my real story. When we were back in the car and on the road, I leaned my head back against the seat and faked a yawn.
"Tired?"
said Tate. "A little."
"You can go ahead and sleep," he said. "I was just kidding about making you keep me company."
I yawned again.
"Thanks."
The night grew darker as we drove west. I pretended to drift off, but I don't sleep anymore. Rain came and went in quick taps on the windshield. The air smelled like ozone and exhaust and manure. The man murmured to himself from time to time. I couldn't make out the words. A couple of hours outside Lincoln, he turned the signal on, slowed the car, and eased to an exit. I kept my eyes closed. I felt a stop for a moment. Then we turned right. The road was rough and loud beneath the tires. He drove for another 20-30 minutes before stopping. He turned off the engine. His seatbelt clicked and rasped as it retracted.
"Nobody will know,"
he said, a whisper under his breath.
"It's okay. It's okay. Nobody will know."
There was a soft thump as he hit the steering wheel with both palms. I waited for the fear. He had made his choice. I should be scared now. But all I felt was tired. Tired, and disappointed that I had been right. He could have kept driving through the night and into the morning. He didn't have to stop.
"Nobody will know,"
he said again. I opened my eyes. He was looking right at me.
"Don't move,"
he said. His voice shook. He gripped the steering wheel. His lower lip was trembling, his shoulders tense, the line of his neck taut as a steel cable.
"Don't move, you stupid, you freaky bitch! What are you doing?"
I didn't say anything. I wasn't moving. I wasn't doing anything except waiting.
"How stupid are you?"
He hit the steering wheel again.
"What the hell did you expect? Getting into a car with a stranger? Didn't your mother tell you that's asking for trouble?"
I clenched my hands together in my lap. I could barely remember how it had happened before, when I'd woken in the grave with the stranger kneeling over me.
"You should have known better,"
he said. "I know," I said. He launched himself across the car and slammed my head into the window. The angle was bad. He was shaking and grasping, but I felt his fingers dig into my neck, pressing against my windpipe. He wasn't strong enough to hold me. He didn't know what he was doing. But I didn't try to push him away. All I did was close one hand over each wrist, and I pulled. The shadowed vines wrapped around us, an impenetrable tangle. His eyes went wide with surprise and anger. Anger that I would fight back. Anger that it wasn't going to be easy. His face turned red and beads of sweat formed on his brow. His pupils were dilated, his mouth open slightly, pink tongue pressed between crooked front teeth. He was trying to say something. His lips moved, fish-like, but the only sound he could make was a weak, kittenish mewl. Something dark and oily inside him snapped. I felt his heartbeat once, twice, stuttering, and no more. I was standing in a kitchen. I was raising a baseball bat. I was swinging it down. A small body crumpled before me. The man's hands dropped from my neck. I shoved him away, and he slumped against the steering wheel. His eyes were open, his mouth gaping. He was dead. I pushed the door open and tripped out. My heart was racing, my breath coming in quick, painful gasps. I dropped to my knees, gagged and spat on the ground. I felt like I was buzzing on caffeine, on adrenaline, trembling so bad it was all I could do to crawl away from the car. I curled onto my side and lay there for a long time in the glow from the headlights. And I remembered. A little kid. A boy. He had killed a little boy who liked baseball and video games and had come home early to get a snack of peanut butter and crackers. The brat wasn't supposed to be there. Not while his mom was at work. There was an open jar of peanut butter on the counter, a glass of milk beside it. The kid was always sticking his fingers in the jar. His blood spread across the yellow linoleum floor. He wasn't supposed to be there. His baseball bat was supposed to be in his room, or in the garage, not right there in the living room. He was always sticking his nose where it didn't belong. He would still be alive if he had put his bat away, if he knew how to keep his mouth shut, if he for once in his life had used a knife to spread the peanut butter instead of sticking his fingers in the jar. A long time passed before I was able to sit up. A mosquito whined in my ear. I waved it away. We were parked on a rutted dirt driveway by a narrow road. Lights of isolated farmhouses shone in the distance. The car clicked as the engine cooled. The night was quiet, the prairie grass damp with rain. My hands shook as I rubbed them through the wet blades, wiped them over my mouth. I spat again. When I was certain I could move without my heart bursting in my chest, I walked back to the car and took my backpack and skateboard out of the back seat. I found the man's wallet in his pocket. I didn't steal anything. I only wanted to know his real name. I tucked my sleeve over my hand and wiped my fingerprints from the inside of the car. Anything else they found, if they looked, would be too degraded to identify me. Natural causes. That's what they would decide. His heart had stopped. Suspicious, out there on that empty road. So far from home. But there was no sign of foul play. I looked at him closely. He didn't look any different. He wasn't gray or shriveled or pale. The clinging black tangle that had hung around him was gone. What I felt in its place was an electric hum beneath my skin, the steady thump of my heart, a deep, dull ache in the bruises around my neck. I slammed the car door. The light went out. I wanted him to look on the outside as he did on the inside. I wanted to feel guilty or sick or scared about what I had done. I wanted to regret it. I didn't. He had been a murderer. Now he was a dead murderer. I walked to the road and dropped my skateboard to the asphalt. I was only 50% sure I was heading toward the highway. I didn't care. I pushed myself faster and faster, much faster than I would normally go on a rough road in the dark, racing and reckless. The night air was cold and damp on my face, in my hair, on my tongue. It felt wonderful, the cleanest exhilaration you can imagine. I never wanted to stop. Chapter 4. His real name was Duncan Palmer. He was 47 years old. He had been a bank teller in Minneapolis, but he had recently been fired from his job for losing his temper and making threatening comments to customers. He told his friends he was going to take a vacation to get his head together before he found another job. He had been arrested 2 years ago as a suspect in the death of his ex-girlfriend's son. No charges were filed and he was released. The boy had caught him with the 16-year-old babysitter while his mother was at work. The girl had run away, humiliated, and Duncan Palmer had panicked. He hit the kid repeatedly over the head with a baseball bat. The bat had been a birthday present from Palmer a few months earlier. He had spent too much money on a good one, never mind that the boy was the worst player on his Little League team and the mother wasn't impressed. The boy had died on the kitchen floor. Duncan Palmer wrapped the body in plastic and drove out of the city to dump it. A woman walking her dog found the boy the next day. The cops suspected the man from the start, but the babysitter lied and Palmer lied. The mother lied and swore he would never hurt her son. Maybe she even believed it. The case went unsolved. They blamed it on a home invasion gone bad. Not all of that was in the news, but there was enough in the memories for me to put the story together. By the time I met him, Duncan Palmer was thinking about doing it again. The possibility was there in the back of his mind, wrapped up on those vines and thorns that tasted of ash, deep and thrumming like a distant drumbeat. He had gotten away with it before. It had been the most exciting day of his life. He was the second man I killed. Some days I feel bad about it. Most days I don't. The kid was short, chubby, with dirt brown hair and brown eyes. He only wanted a snack. I can still smell the peanut butter. Chapter 5. Duncan Palmer had driven us several miles along a county road north of I-80, through gently rolling fields surrounded by wire fences. It was a dark night, most of the sky covered with clouds. The pavement was uneven and rough, difficult to skate on, but I barely noticed. I kicked and kicked, and my legs never grew tired. I was energized, my nerves sparking, my blood flowing, my heart beating so strong I could feel it in my ears and my fingertips. I wound my way along the grid of country roads for miles. Trees loomed beside the road, dropped away as I passed them, and insects buzzed in the darkness. A few cars passed, headlights bright and white. Some slowed when they saw me, but none stopped. The rich night air rushed over me, soft on my skin, cool through my hair. My mind was empty. I crashed once, not entirely on purpose. I knew I was going too fast when I crested the hill, but I didn't slow down. I hit a pothole in the asphalt near the bottom, on the outside edge of a sharp turn. My skateboard went left, and I went right. The momentum carried me straight into the trunk of a tree. I lay on the ground for a few minutes, dazed and hurting. I moved my head, neck, arms, hands. I probed at the abrasions on my face. If there were hairline fractures in my ribs or cracks in my skull, they would heal themselves. If there was blood collecting in my brain, it would drain away. The scratches on my chin and cheek bled sluggishly for a minute or two, then stopped. I would have fading yellow bruises and new scars by morning. The worst of the pain passed. I sat up, took my notebook out of my backpack. It was too dark for me to read what was already written on the page, but I didn't need to. I knew the list by heart. I had started writing it shortly after I woke up. A record of experimental trial and error. All the ways I could not die. I added one more line. 8. Skated face first into tree. As failed deaths went, that one was pretty embarrassing. But in the spirit of scientific inquiry, I couldn't leave it out. I sat cross-legged beside the road until the sting in my skin faded. Then I found my skateboard, and I kept going. The clouds gathered and parted through the night. It rained a few times, and my hair and clothes grew damp. But it always passed. I stopped once at an empty intersection, not because I needed a breath and not because I cared that I was lost. I only wanted to taste the cool, damp air and listen to the quiet. There was enough of a clear patch overhead for me to recognize the broad W of Cassiopeia, but I couldn't see much else. As I watched, the clouds drifted over her. It figured that now that I was here, in the dark, in the middle of nowhere, no cities to speak of for hundreds of miles, it was too cloudy to see anything. But I didn't have to leave. The thought drifted into my mind, curious and bright, like a fish behind the curved glass of an aquarium. I didn't have to keep moving. If I wanted, I could lie down in one of these fields. It wouldn't matter if it rained because I couldn't get sick. I didn't have to worry about the cold. I didn't have to eat. I didn't have to sleep or find a safe place or do anything at all. I could lie beneath a shade tree and use my backpack as a pillow and wait through the day, watch the clouds clear, watch the sunset, watch the stars come out again. I could do that for as many nights as I cared to count. I could never see anybody again. No murderers. No memories. Eventually, the hollow cold that wasn't hunger would fill me again. But I could wait it out. Maybe my heart would slow. My blood would grow sluggish in my veins. My lungs would spasm and shudder when I tried to breathe. And maybe I wouldn't mind so much. Out here with nothing around but grass and stars. With no people dragging their guilt and grief and anger behind them like oily dark banners. I had left home after I woke up because it was impossible for me to stay. There was a breezy-shaped hole in the life I had once occupied. The girl I had been was gone. I didn't know what I was anymore. I went west because it was as good a direction as any, and because I thought I might like to reach the Pacific Ocean before I made another decision. But I didn't have a plan. For the first time in my life, I didn't have any idea what I could or should do next. I didn't have anywhere to be. Nobody was waiting for me. Nobody was expecting to see me ever again. Grass rustled nearby, and I started, spun so quickly I nearly lost my balance. It was only the wind pushing leaves against each other. I let out a loud breath, shook my head, and turned again. There was something in the intersection. It was pale and translucent and drifting a foot above the asphalt. It had the basic shape of a human body, limbs, torso, smudge of a head. The legs ended in shredded rags, the arms in spidery threads. I thought, Mom and Dad would be so disappointed. They had always told us there was no such thing as ghosts. No ghosts or spirits, no heaven or hell, no afterlife. When my youngest sister, Sunny, asked what happened to us when we died, our middle sister, Meadow, had scoffed and said, "You rot and worms eat your brains, stupid." Mom and Dad had hushed her, told her not to frighten Sunny, and they had explained that all that remained were the memories of our loved ones carried with them and the impact of the things we had accomplished. Nothing in their view of the world allowed for the possibility of ghosts in empty intersections, shadows clinging to murderers, or the half-dead thing I had become. "Hi," I said. The ghost had no face. It drifted in the breeze, like a tattered flag on a pole, but it gave no sign that it had heard me. It didn't come closer. It didn't move away. It didn't do anything. I walked around it in a slow circle. It didn't turn. I reached out to touch it. It felt like nothing at all, not even a cool puff of air. It had dark smears where its eyes ought to be. I stopped bothering the ghost and headed west along the road again. When I looked back, it was still there, a pale drift above the road, tiny in the dark prairie night. Chapter 6. The night I died was warm and clear. I remember joking with Melanie when we slammed the doors of her mom's car, the minivan with the stick figure family displayed on the back window. Two parents, two kids, two dogs. I remember laughing as we dodged sprinklers on somebody's lawn and slipped on the grass. Everything was laughter and light and fun. There was nothing before us but our last summer of high school stretching long and open. Later, she would recoil, and my face would sting where she slapped me, and I would leave the party alone. Later still, I would grow cold and stiff in a backyard grave, but I don't remember that. On the day I came back to life, hundreds of birds within a 2-mile radius dropped dead with no warning, and a freak storm covered the city with frost. I don't remember much of the year in between. I don't remember the police, the searches, the interviews. I don't remember the headlines. Evanston teen missing. I don't remember the articles. Breezy Lynn, 17, was reported missing by parents David Lynn and Aaron Donahue after she failed to return home from a party on Saturday night. I don't remember the interviews, the speculation, the online comments, the inevitable school assembly. I don't remember my parents giving press conferences, my sisters beside them. Sunny cried and Meadow scowled while Mom and Dad held my picture and pleaded. But I don't remember it. I don't remember that picture appearing every night on the local news. Last year's school photo, taken when my hair was longer and I was wearing an electric blue shirt I had since given to Meadow. I don't remember the posters stapled up around town. I don't remember the police dogs barking and tugging through the neighborhood. They had no chance of finding me. I don't smell like myself anymore. I'm too degraded. I don't remember any of it. I read about it afterward. You don't sleep when you're dead, but you can dream. During that year I lay buried in my grave, I dreamed about darkness and space and silence. During that year, I was alone. I always wanted to be an astronaut when I grew up. Not in the casual, half-hearted way all kids want to be astronauts when they go through their drawing pictures of Saturn phase, but truly, earnestly. I was going to be a member of the first manned mission to Mars. I decided when I was 7, and when I was 11, I worked it all out. The classes I would take in high school and what I would study in college. How long it would take me to get my PhD in astrophysics or planetary geology or engineering. The research projects I would do. The grants and internships I would get. All of it with the space program in mind. I seriously considered joining the Air Force, but decided a career in scientific research was a better option. I had a long-term plan and a carefully annotated schedule in my desk drawer. I convinced my teachers to let me create independent math courses so I would already know calculus by the time I enrolled at MIT. I signed up for swimming lessons so I could ace NASA's swimming requirement. I wrote practice answers to imaginary interview questions. I asked my parents if I could go on a parabolic flight for vacation, rather than our usual summer at the cottage on Lake Michigan. I had files and calendars and an entire shelf full of astronaut biographies. I had a map of Mars on my bedroom wall, another of the moon, and a space shuttle poster signed by Sally Ride and Mae Jemison. I had a t-shirt with a drawing of the cosmonaut dog Laika, and would tell anybody who asked all about how she had died a horrible death alone and in pain above the Earth. Melanie said it was creepy that I knew that, and I probably shouldn't talk about it if I wanted to keep my friends. I thought twice about wearing my Laika t-shirt after that. But I didn't stop. I just wore it when Melanie wasn't around. A future in space was the only thing I had ever wanted. My parents encouraged me. They were proud of my dreams and my determination. They told me I could do it, and I believed them. I imagined hundreds of times what it would be like to float above the Earth, a clear marble of green and blue and white below me, the stars at my back, specks of light in the cold and the silence, and the vast, incomprehensible beauty of the universe. Every astronaut, every cosmonaut, all the women and men who have gone into space, they all say the same thing. They went up expecting to be awed by the moon and the sun and the stars, but what astonished them most was the Earth. Michael Collins, the astronaut who orbited the moon in Apollo 11 command module while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin left footprints on the surface, once said that what he thought when he looked down at the Earth was, "My God, that little thing is so fragile out there." Being dead isn't like that. Unfamiliar white stars pinpricked the darkness all around me, tiny and bright and impossibly distant. There was no Earth, no moon, no sun, no strange planets wrapped in rings, no colorful nebulas or vast clouds of gas. Only stars. No matter which way I turned, drifting and spinning helplessly in slow circles, nothing new ever came into view. My heart wasn't beating. I didn't breathe. I didn't think about anything. The year passed, but I didn't feel it. All I felt was cold. I didn't know I was waking up until it had already happened. The birds started dying after midnight. The first people to notice were the early morning birders out before dawn, armed with their notebooks and binoculars, wrapped in scarves and puffy down coats against the surprise cold. They saw their blue jays and orioles and herons all struck dead on their migration north. The bird watchers called animal control, and animal control called an environmental consultant, and the consultant called a wildlife biologist. And before the morning was over, dozens of little feathered bodies were packed away in plastic bags and coolers and carried off to be tested. All over the city, people were checking their backyards and gutters and warning their kids not to touch the corpses. In homes and pet stores, parakeets and finches and parrots were dropping dead in their cages. The frost melted away before noon, and the birds kept dying. On the news, a scientist insisted the freak cold snap had nothing to do with it, never mind that it was the middle of June and Illinois was ready for summer. The last birds died just before midnight, and I came back. One moment I was in the darkness, surrounded by stars, and the next I was coughing and choking. I couldn't move. There was something crushing me from all sides. When I tried to open my eyes, I felt a sharp, stinging pain. I couldn't see. The stars were gone, and there was no light. I tried to breathe, my lungs heaving and burning, but my mouth and throat were packed with dirt. I kicked and clawed, and slowly, slowly, the soil above me loosened. I wasn't buried very deep. 18 inches, no more. But I was so weak I couldn't break through to the surface. I was thrashing and squirming, trying to push the soil away. And that's when I felt the man's hands on my face and heard his excited whispers. Somebody besides the birders and the scientists had noticed the dying birds. Somebody who recognized the signs and knew that no natural weather phenomenon was responsible. I grabbed his wrists. A thick, nauseating darkness washed over me, more suffocating than the soil, oily and slick and sickening. I thought, killer. I thought, murderer. I only had to touch him and I knew what he was. I was holding his wrists, but it wasn't flesh and bone I was feeling. It was the sick, slippery guilt inside the meat shell. I pulled without thinking, without hesitating, and he snapped. He was there one moment and gone the next. A lightning bolt of memories and blood and exhilaration exploded through me. My heart shuddered, squeezed, began to beat again. I hauled myself out of the grave. I fell onto my hands and knees, heaving and vomiting. I began to shiver. I was crying, tears streaking down my face, painful sobs shaking my body. I dug my fingers into my mouth to clear the dirt away, gagged and vomited again until my stomach ached and my throat burned. I wiped a hand over my mouth and looked at the man lying on the ground. I checked his pulse because I thought I should, not because I didn't already know. His face was turned into the grass. He had a spot of thinning hair on the back of his head. He had killed 5 people one winter night 30 years ago. My ears rang with gunshots and screams. A woman's pleading voice. Only after several gasping minutes did the images soften, the smells fade, and I understood it was a memory. I didn't feel weak anymore, but the nausea lingered. My blood was humming in my veins and my lips tingled. I spat on the grass. There was dirt in my teeth. My heart was thundering in my chest. I could feel the air filling my lungs, the muscles of my abdomen clenching, the nerves in my skin waking and pricking with pain. I could feel all of it. The awareness was overwhelming. In the darkness, surrounded by distant stars, there had been no time. But now I was counting the seconds with every breath and every heartbeat. I breathed until my head stopped spinning. Every gulp of cold air was the best thing I had ever tasted. I lifted my head, waited to make sure I wasn't going to topple over, and stood. I was in the backyard of a two-story house. There was no light through the back door or any of the windows. Somewhere nearby, dogs were barking, angry and insistent. I realized I had been hearing them for some time. I crossed the lawn, fumbled at the gate, pushed it open. I kicked something soft and looked down. A little bird, still and brown and dead. I stared at it, waiting for a pang of revulsion. But I felt nothing. I brushed over its feathers with my bare toes. It was such a tiny thing, barely the size of my fist. My eyes were gritty with dirt, scraping with every blink. But I recognized the neighborhood. I was only a couple of blocks from home. Chapter 7. It began to rain as dawn crept over western Nebraska. Within minutes I was soaked through, head to toe, but it was another few miles before I skated into a small town and found shelter in the local McDonald's. My shoes skidded on the tile floor when I stepped inside. Shivering with cold, I went into the bathroom to change into the clothes I had taken from a laundromat before leaving Chicago. The jeans were so long I had to roll them up, and the Wonder Woman t-shirt was meant for a little girl with a flat chest. I couldn't do anything about the shoes. I didn't have another pair. I finger-combed my hair into a ponytail, wrung out my scarf, and wrapped it again around my neck. It was clammy and uncomfortable, but it was better than letting people stare at the bruises. My grandmother used to say, "You look like death warmed over," when my mother was tired or sick or worn down. I always thought it was a funny thing to say. I imagined coffins lined up on a baking sheet, sprinkled with sugar and frosting and ready to go into the oven. Grandma Elaine had died when I was 8. We went to San Francisco for her funeral, an open casket service, and I remember looking down at her thin white hair and pale face, stiff and unnatural beneath the heavy makeup, and knowing better than to ask my mother if it was time for Grandma to be warmed up now. It was cold in San Francisco that spring, rainy and gray everywhere we went, and I was worried Grandma would feel that way forever. I didn't look like death warmed over. My face wasn't going gray. My skin wasn't shriveling up. My nails weren't yellowing and long. There were no hollow holes of rot opening in my face. I looked like a drowned rat in ill-fitting vagrant chic clothes, but otherwise I looked like myself. There was a faint flush to my cheeks and my eyes were bright. I looked alive. The cashier behind the counter raised her eyebrows when I walked up to order.
"Get caught out?" she said.
"A little bit," I said.
"What can I get for you?"
"A small coffee, please." I dug into my backpack for the 20 the friendly stoner had given to me when we parted ways in Iowa City.
"And?"
She was a middle-aged woman with graying hair and deep lines around her eyes. Her fingers twitched over the register. "That's it," I said. "I can't eat anymore. Everything tastes like dust." I walked to a seat by the window. My shoes squelched. I felt the familiar tug as I passed a group of old men and women chatting over coffee and styrofoam plates of pancakes. Killer. Killer. Their shadows were old and frail, spiderweb wispy. The men were veterans. One of them was wearing a POW/MIA hat, another a U.S. Navy jacket. One of the old women, too. Killer. That would have surprised me before, when I was first feeling out the limits of my new sense. But an old lady in a pink cardigan is just as likely to be a murderer as anybody else. The woman caught me staring. I turned away. The rain showed no sign of letting up. Trucks passing on the interstate sent waves of water over the guardrails. I sat at my table by the window and shivered. I tried not to think too much about what I was doing and where I was going. I would worry about that when the rain stopped. I took the notebook out of my backpack and unhooked the pen from the spiral. I turned to the third page and wrote, Duncan Palmer, little boy with a baseball bat. I breathed in the scent of the coffee to chase away the phantom smell of peanut butter. The only other words on the page were, Man by grave, family of five with shotgun and knife. One didn't mean anything, but two was a body count. I was tempted to number them, neat digits at the front of each line. But I didn't want one and two to imply there would be a three and four. Instead, I turned to a clean page and drew a long vertical line down the middle, another line across the top. At the top of one column, I wrote, Real, and atop the other column, I wrote, Not Real. On the first line of the first column, I wrote, Whatever I am. Below that, Ghosts. The Not Real column remained empty for now. I drank my dust-flavored coffee as slowly as I could, but soon the cup was empty. It was still raining. I was cold and filthy and uncomfortable, and I smelled like a bum who had been sleeping in a dumpster. There was grime underneath my fingernails, and my hair was tangled in knots. The nighttime exhilaration of racing along country roads in the darkness was gone. I wasn't sure how long I could hang around McDonald's before the employees asked me to leave. I found Danny's blue flyer, unfolded the paper, and smoothed it down on the tabletop. Church of the Prairie. I had no idea where I was in relation to that cross on the map. Nebraska had a lot of prairie and a lot of churches. I didn't need help. I definitely didn't need a hot meal. But a shower and clean clothes would be nice. I grabbed the flyer and walked over to the table of old men and women. Excuse me, I said. I held out the blue paper and tried to look as pathetic as possible. I didn't mean to bother you, but I was wondering, do you know where this is? Is it near here? One of the women smiled. It was a kindly grandmother's smile, crinkling up her face and warming her eyes. I wondered who she had killed. Her guilt was delicate and sharp, like brittle rose thorns in an old, old garden. It's not too close, sweetie, but it's not too far either, she said. Can you tell me how to get there? She took the flyer from me. Oh, we can't let you go out in that storm again. You're so little you'll get swept away. They all laughed, and I laughed too. They invited me to have a seat. I looked harmless. Chapter 8. I decided shortly after waking up that I needed to take a rational approach to figuring out what happened to me. The first page of my notebook contains the record of that brief burst of scientific enthusiasm. On the top line in block letters, I wrote, Research. And beneath it, Preliminary research indicates that subject is not a living human person anymore. A review of the available literature is unclear on whether this state is permanent. By review of the available literature, I meant I had Googled, How do I not be undead anymore? And come up empty. Subject is still able to breathe, but respiration is not necessary. A similar situation persists with the circulatory system.